The headlines: the Turkish president says terrorist groups in Syria are armed by Western countries as he attends a trilateral summit with his Russian and Iranian counterparts in Tehran. Ranil Wickremesinghe becomes Sri Lanka's new president days after Gotabaya Rajapaksa resigned amid protests over an unprecedented economic crisis. China accuses the United States of creating security risks in the Taiwan Strait after another U.S. warship sailed through the sensitive waterway. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says a military action in northern Syria would definitely harm Turkey, Syria, and the region as a whole. Ayatollah Khamenei said fighting terrorism is a must, but a military incursion in Syria will benefit terrorists alone. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comments in a meeting with the Turkish president in Tehran. Recep Tayyip Erdogan also said the terrorist groups in Syria are supported and armed by Western countries, including the U.S. Also on Tuesday, Iran's leader met with the Russian president. Ayatollah Khamenei said Tehran and Moscow need to be vigilant against what he called the West's deceptive policies. He described NATO as a dangerous entity which knows no limits. Ayatollah Khamenei also called for de-dollarization in international trade transactions. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the integrity and independence of Syria must be respected, and a military intervention in the Arab country will only worsen the situation there. Raisi said the fate of Syria must be determined by its own people and without any foreign interference. He underscored Israel's attacks against the Arab country, saying the regime's actions threaten peace and security in the region. The Iranian president made the remarks after a trilateral summit with his Russian and Turkish counterparts on Syria. The summit was held in Tehran on Tuesday. It took place within the framework of the Astana peace process that Tehran, Moscow, and Ankara launched in 2017 to find a political situation to the crisis in Syria.
During a joint press conference, which followed the latest round of their Astana process talks, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi welcomed the Russian and Turkish presidents, along with their accompanying delegations, to the summit. Raisi stressed the need to protect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Syria, as well as the importance of the fight against terrorism.
Discussions focused on the sovereignty of Syria and the territorial integrity of the country, emphasizing that the Syrian government must rule over all parts of the country and that the presence of Americans on the eastern banks of the Euphrates is not acceptable and they must withdraw, and all parts of the country must be governed by the legitimate government. We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism, and there is the need to do so, and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region. The all-out fight against terrorism by the Islamic Republic of Iran was a successful experience. I commemorate Lieutenant General Soleimani as the icon of resistance and combating terrorism. All countries have fought against terrorism, but today there are concerns about the presence of terrorists in Syria. So there is a need for firm results to be achieved by all states that participate in the fight against terrorism.
Russian President Vladimir Putin echoed similar remarks and highlighted the importance of the Astana process.
We agreed.
In order to normalize the situation in Syria, all three countries have agreed that full settlement of the conflict is only possible through political means and holding talks based on UNSC Resolution 2254, and while observing the basic principle of sovereignty and territorial integrity and unity of Syria. All these principles must be respected, and the future of Syria must be dictated by its own people, and nothing should be dictated from the outside.
Putin added that all sides have called for the continuation of the fight against terrorism and extremism so that such threats will be eliminated. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, while echoing the remarks made by his counterparts, also pointed out the importance of finding a sustainable political solution to the Syrian situation.
The crisis in Syria can only be resolved through political dialogue.
We also discussed our future steps. We told our partners in the Astana process that political dialogue must be accelerated. The next round of talks related to the Constitutional Committee must be held and must reach a conclusion within the framework set by the UN and based on UN Security Council Resolution 2254. It must be implemented to help bring about peace and tranquility to Syria.
Also in Tehran, a group of Iranian protesters gathered outside the Swedish embassy to denounce a recent ruling by the Stockholm District Court that sentenced Iranian national Hamid Nouri to life in prison. Nouri has been facing trial in Sweden over alleged rights abuses. Yusuf Jalali has the details on that.
Illegal and politically motivated. That's how these angry protesters describe a Swedish court ruling sentencing Iranian national Hamid Nouri of life in jail, convicted by the Stockholm District Court on July 14th of taking part in the 1988 execution of members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization. Protesters here warn that the Swedish verdict has sent negative signals to Iranians.
We gathered outside the Swedish embassy today to demand an end to Sweden's circus trial of Hamid Nouri.
Sweden has no jurisdiction to rule on a case that's considered a domestic issue in Iran. Besides, all of the witnesses who testified against Mr. Nouri were members of a terror group and have never seen Nouri in person in Iran.
The accusations were leveled against Nouri by members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror group, or MKO. Protesters here say the MKO itself has committed countless war crimes, from aiding former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s Iran-Iraq War to the serial killings of Iranian statesmen and civilians in the early years after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The MKO was on the U.S. and EU's blacklist of terrorist organizations before both countries delisted the group in 2012 and 2009, respectively.
The MKO have the blood of at least 12,000 Iranians on their hands. They have no position amongst Iranians, and we call them the hypocrites here in Iran. So I want to tell the Swedish prosecutor that a ruling is tantamount to approving the crimes committed by MKO terrorists against Iranians.
Iran says Hamid Nouri has for the past 32 months been kept in abysmal conditions in a solitary confinement in Sweden. Hamid Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in 2019 and was immediately imprisoned. A life sentence in Sweden generally means a minimum of 20 to 25 years in prison. Nouri can appeal the verdict.
Protesters here called the whole shebang as a political game aimed at smearing the Islamic Republic's justice system. They described the Swedish ruling as rabble-rousing, which whitewashes terrorism and gives a green light to the ill intentions of the MKO against Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In Sri Lanka, incumbent Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe has won a parliamentary vote to serve the country for the next 5 years as president. Wickremesinghe won a three-way contest. That's a week after Gotabaya Rajapakse was forced to resign and flee the country amid nationwide protests over an unprecedented economic crisis. In a speech following his election as the new head of state, Wickremesinghe said divisions are now over. He will take charge of a bankrupt nation that is in bailout talks with the International Monetary Fund. The island nation is in the grip of worst crisis in over 7 decades, facing severe shortages of food, fuel, and medicine. Wickremesinghe is also widely despised by the protesters, who see him pursuing the policy of the former president. China has denounced the sailing of yet another U.S. warship through the Taiwan Strait, saying the move undermines peace and stability. The Chinese Army, in a statement, said it monitored the warship and issued a warning. The statement accused the U.S. of frequent provocations and called it a creator of security risks in the Taiwan Strait. The U.S. Navy claimed, however, that its destroyer USS Benfold conducted a routine transit in accordance with international law. Just a week ago, the same destroyer twice sailed through the disputed South China Sea. The U.S. has been carrying out such voyages regularly. China, which claims Taiwan as its own territory, blames the U.S. for interfering in the island's affairs. Beijing is also angry over Washington's growing military and diplomatic ties with the self-ruled island. We're watching Press TV's News Review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, scientists are warning of high levels of ozone pollution driven by record-breaking temperatures and raging wildfires in Europe, according to the EU's Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service. Ozone pollution has increased in southern and western regions and could soon reach northwestern areas. The monitoring center was warned that the surface-level ozone can worsen respiratory and cardiovascular illnesses. Ferocious heat wave has hit swaths of Europe, with Britain recording temperatures over 40 degrees Celsius for the first time. The heat wave has also sparked devastating wildfires in Spain, France, Greece, Italy, Portugal, and England. Over 1,700 people have so far lost their lives from heat-related causes, while thousands of hectares of forests and grasslands have been destroyed. Studies show climate change is making heat waves hotter, more frequent, and longer lasting. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Robert Carter, who's joining us from London. Also, we have Jerome Hughes, who's joining us from Brussels. Let's start off with Robert. A lot going on there. 40 degrees Celsius for the first time was recorded in Britain. What does this heat wave mean for the country?
Well, of course, it's unprecedented. Records are being broken with this latest wave. But of course, what's happened now is that, you know, warnings were put out. Many people were being advised, you know, stay hydrated, stay in if possible. Try not to put yourself under conditions which might put your life at risk. But no one really suspected that we were going to see wildfires of this magnitude in the UK. This is just something that we don't really get here normally. All the years that I've lived here, I can't remember anything of this level taking place here. So what's happened now is that bigger crisis has developed, where our fire brigade service is being pushed to its absolute limits. People are already beginning to ask questions about government cuts to these vital public services. And once again, people, there are deaths being reported. So depending on the final death count that comes out of this, the government may face renewed pressure over cuts to services, vitally needed services, including emergency services. So there is going to be more to come from this. Obviously, right now, everyone's trying to deal with the initial fires, which are still raging in some parts of the country, including the capital, London, which was affected very badly yesterday. So, of course, there's going to be bigger issues over this. But again, I think the debate surrounding climate change and global warming, they're also going to resurface in the weeks following this continent-wide heat apocalypse, as it's being described by some.
Let's cross over to Jerome Hughes in Brussels. Jerome, how's this overall affecting Europe? And I think the main question here would be what needs to be done, and quickly for that matter, to respond to the issue of climate change.
Well, Barty, there's no doubt about it. It's serious stuff. I mean, in France and Spain, we've seen thousands of hectares of forests that have been destroyed. Thousands of people have been evacuated from their homes. In Spain, there were 30 forest fires, 220 square kilometres of land scorched, blackened by fires in Spain alone. Portugal, four major fires were brought under control on Monday. Gironde, which is an area of Bordeaux, it's just southwestern France, 37,000 people were evacuated from their homes, 37,000 people from their homes, and also holidaymakers as well, so people's holidays destroyed. Here in Belgium yesterday, we had 39 degrees Celsius on Tuesday. The record here is 41.8 degrees. That was in July 2019, so it was close to the record. But when we were talking about this the last time, I was talking to you about the potential for flooding after the heat wave, because, you know, we have a prolonged period of very dry conditions. That means the ground is very dry. And actually, it's starting. We've had major claps of thunder in the past half hour. It's starting to rain now, but we're actually forecast for thunderstorms from 4 p.m. today, local time in Belgium, which are scheduled, forecast to go on raining, actually heavy rains between now and Saturday. So, you know, the ground is dry. It's not absorbing the moisture. Therefore, you have the potential for floods. It was in July last year, Press TV was out in the eastern part of Belgium, where villages were wiped out. People were killed with floods. Also in western parts of Germany, that happened too. So we have the potential now after this huge heat wave or and a prolonged period of heat, we have the potential for floods. And then you have the economic element to this as well. I mean, because of the high temperatures yesterday, and temperatures have dropped now, by the way, so we're talking about, you know, sort of early to mid-20s in terms of the degrees Celsius. But at the same time, many businesses didn't bother opening, Robert would tell you, in the UK yesterday and also here in the EU. And there was major disruption to travel. So there's a massive economic impact. Maybe that's not a big headline story this time because we've had so much disruption due to COVID-19 in terms of businesses being closed. But we cannot underestimate the economic impact of this. And of course, as you mentioned, the experts are saying it's all about the climate change. So we could be seeing, you know, we could have a situation like this happening again later this summer, but certainly in the years to come where we have record temperatures.
Same question to Robert. Robert, should this be simply treated as a heat wave during the holidays, or is this a warning of worse to come?
No, it's definitely a warning of worse to come, I would say. Yes, we have to see how things develop, because if this happens on a more regular basis over, let's say, the next 5-10 years, then of course the UK is going to have to totally adapt itself to a new climate, something which it is not used to. Jerome said quite rightly that it's not just the wildfires, which are of course headline grabbing, which have affected us. Public transport has ground to a halt. The economy actually took a bit of a hit because of the lack of productivity. People's homes, again, are not built to sustain or to manage this type of heat. So again, people are suffering deaths in some cases because they're living in conditions where it's too hot. And if people don't take those extra measures to protect themselves, hydrate and stuff like that, then of course we're going to face loss of life, particularly in the elderly community. And of course, newborns as well are also very risk prone in these kinds of conditions. So again, we'll have to educate people in society how to deal with this, because these are challenges which people, let's say in the Middle East, would be used to facing and know how to deal with those challenges. But a lot of people here in countries like the UK, we have absolutely no idea about or even take these types of conditions seriously enough in order to make sure that people are properly protected. But there was absolute chaos yesterday. Train systems shutting down, huge cancellations. People just couldn't travel around London at all. And even roads were buckling under the heat pressure. There were cracks developing in the roads and things like that. So this country is not built for these types of conditions. And if they become more regular, then there's going to be some major changes needed, a huge overhaul done of the way this country is run.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Robert Carter joining us from London, and also Dario and Jerome Hughes speaking to us from Brussels. That's a wrap for now. Goodbye, everybody.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the breadth, speed, and seriousness of the criminal investigation into election meddling by former President Donald Trump and his associates in Georgia were underscored on Friday, 15th of July, by the revelation that two pro-Trump state senators and the chair of the state Republican Party were sent letters by an Atlanta prosecutor informing them they could be indicted, according to a person familiar with the inquiry. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Richard Fawcett and Danny Hakim. The piece is titled, Prosecutor Warns Georgia Officials They May Face Charges in Trump Inquiry. In the U.S., the breadth, speed, and seriousness of the criminal investigation into election meddling by former President Donald J. Trump and his associates in Georgia were underscored on Friday, 15th of July, by the revelation that two pro-Trump state senators and the chair of the Republican Party in Georgia were sent letters by an Atlanta prosecutor informing them they could be indicted, according to a person familiar with the inquiry. The Fulton County prosecutor in Georgia, Fannie Willis, is also weighing whether to subpoena Donald Trump himself and seek his testimony before a grand jury, just days after she subpoenaed seven of Trump's advisers, including Rudolph Giuliani and Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, in an investigation into efforts to overturn Donald Trump's 2020 election loss in Georgia. The special grand jury is looking into a range of potentially criminal acts, including the selection of a state of pro-Trump electors in the weeks after the election and Donald Trump's now famous call to Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Secretary of State, asking him to find nearly 12,000 votes that would reverse his loss in that state. The letters to David Schaefer, the Georgia Republican Party chair, and state senators Burt Jones and Brandon Beach were first reported by Yahoo News. Neither the men nor their lawyers could be reached for comment on Friday, 15th of July. The potential exposure of the Republican officials could have serious ramifications in Georgia's November elections, where Burt Jones is the Republican nominee for lieutenant governor. On Friday, his Democratic opponent, Charlie Bailey, released a statement accusing Mr. Jones of being anti-American and unpatriotic for taking part in a failed attempted overthrow of the American government. David Schaefer's fealty to Donald Trump and his baseless claims of a stolen election have put him at odds with Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, as well as Brad Raffensperger, creating an unusual schism within the state Republican Party. Both Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger easily defeated Trump-backed primary challengers this year. The so-called target letters are the latest indication that the Georgia investigation could be one of the most perilous legal problems for Donald Trump and some of his allies. The televised congressional hearings into the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol by Mr. Trump's supporters have captured the attention of many Americans, but it is unclear if they will result in charges from the Justice Department. And a high-profile investigation by the Office of the Manhattan District Attorney into allegations that Donald Trump inflated the value of his assets fell apart this year. Some legal observers have argued that Donald Trump's actions, including his post-election phone calls to Georgia officials like Brad Raffensperger, put him at risk of being indicted on charges of violating relatively straightforward Georgia criminal statutes, including criminal solicitation to commit election fraud. Fannie Willis, in court filings, has indicated that a number of other charges are possible, including racketeering and conspiracy, which could take in a broad roster of pro-Trump associates both inside and outside of Georgia. I do believe that the great likelihood is that he's heading towards an indictment, said Norman Eisen, who served as a special counsel to the House Judiciary Committee during the first Trump impeachment, and who co-wrote a lengthy examination of the Georgia case by the Brookings Institution. Among other things, he said, there is powerful proof of violations of Georgia law in the form of the smoking gun tape of him demanding 11,780 votes, when it is perfectly clear from that tape that he knows those votes do not exist. David Schaefer and Burt Jones were among the 16 alternate pro-Trump electors in Georgia. The state's official electors cast their votes in the Electoral College for Joseph R. Biden Jr. Brandon Beecher's name was mentioned in an email that a Georgia Trump campaign official sent to the pro-Trump electors on 13th of December 2020, the day before the electors met at the Georgia State Capitol. That email, which was described in articles by The Washington Post and CNN last month, instructed them to meet with complete secrecy and discretion and advised them to tell Capitol security personnel that they were attending a meeting with Brandon Beach and Burt Jones. Robert Driscoll, a lawyer for David Schaefer, has argued that there was nothing secret or surreptitious about the meeting of the pro-Trump electors. Robert Driscoll noted that David Schaefer had filed a lawsuit challenging the Georgia election results that had not been ruled upon by 14th of December, the date that presidential electors must cast their votes. The alternate pro-Trump electors were convened for the sole purpose of preserving a remedy in the event the lawsuit succeeded, Mr. Driscoll said in a statement. But Fannie Willis's office in recent subpoenas to potential witnesses in the case has characterized the pro-Trump electors as being part of a multi-state coordinated plan by the Trump campaign to influence the results of the November 2020 presidential election in Georgia and elsewhere. On Wednesday, an independent journalist, George Chidi, testified before the grand jury in downtown Atlanta. Mr. Chidi said in an interview on Friday, George Chidi has previously written about finding the group of pro-Trump electors in a room in the state capitol on 14th of December 2020 and asking a woman in the room what the meeting was about. Education, the woman replied. George Chidi said he was then quickly ushered out of the room and a person was placed by the door to guard it. On Friday, 15th of July, lawyers for Burt Jones, the state senator and Republican nominee for lieutenant governor, filed a motion arguing that Fannie Willis, the district attorney, and her office should be disqualified from any investigation of Burt Jones because she had donated money and participated in a fundraising event for Mr. Bailey, the Democratic lieutenant governor candidate. Jeff DeSantis, a deputy district attorney who serves as a spokesman for Fannie Willis's office, said in a statement that the motion was without merit. Political campaign issues, Mr. DeSantis said, have nothing to do with Fannie Willis's fulfillment of her oath of office to investigate and prosecute crimes occurring in Fulton County, Georgia.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to special coverage on the Astana Peace Process over Syria. It was a big day here in Tehran, a pretty busy schedule for the Iranian government, also administration of President Raisi. They were hosting Turkish and, in order respectively, as they arrived, Turkish President, and also we had President Putin of Russia arriving here in the Iranian capital city, Tehran, for talks within the context of the what is called as the Astana Peace Process. The Astana Peace Process was initiated in 2017 in Kazakhstan, and we had three guarantors there, Turkey, Russia, Iran, And the aim is to come up with a solution to the Syria crisis. Now, in the last round of talks, discussions were held regarding the Syrian Constitutional Committee, refugee issue, humanitarian crisis, Turkey's security concerns, U.S. forces' presence, and the remaining pockets of terrorists. So those were the issues that discussed in previous rounds of negotiations, and also in this round of negotiations, the three presidents of Iran, Russia, and Turkey had their addresses, and they started that meeting, and they all emphasized respect for national sovereignty, territorial integrity of Syria. And President Raisi of Iran also highlighted the fact that extra-regional forces like the U.S. forces must leave the region and Syria. They are plundering Syrian oil. And we also have President Putin hoping that the three guarantors of the Astana peace process are trying their best, and they're trying to end international terrorism, including the one wreaking havoc in Syria, that they try to stabilize the situation there. They need to revive Syria's infrastructure and restore security there. Turkish president also said that Syria should be purged from all kinds of terrorists, and hopefully a political solution could be found. Now, to discuss this a little bit, I'm inviting a couple of guests. We'll have Mark Sloboda, international affairs and security analyst, who's joining me from Moscow, and also Elijah Magnier, journalist, simply analyst in Marseille, France. Good to see you both, gentlemen. Let's start with Mark in Moscow. Well, I just gave you a gist of what's happening here in Tehran as we speak. The three leaders are discussing Syria. Let's begin with how significant this Astana peace process is. As President Putin of Turkey just claimed, that this is the only process that seriously is trying to deal with the issues besetting Syria.
Yeah, I would define the Astana peace process in a little more realist terms. I would define it as Russia and Iran managing their proxy war in Syria with Turkey, because that has been the state of affairs since Russia's intervention in 2015, and for Iran, even longer than that. They are on opposing sides in this conflict. And the Erdogan regime, it continues to occupy large swaths of northern Syria and is ethnically cleansing the territory and continues to support al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, by whatever support it is now. Russia and Iran have managed to weed out all of the other Gulf players through this management of the process with Turkey. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Emirates, they all dropped out of the game, as it were. And right now, it is essentially a Mexican standoff that has been the status quo in the country for years now, with very little changes. And that is the Syrian government, supported by Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, the Turkish regime with its use of al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and other Islamists and jihadists as proxies, and the United States militarily occupying East Syria through its use of the Syrian YPG as their proxy forces. And that standoff continues to this day. And right now, this latest rounds of negotiations were simply Russia and Iran warning Erdogan not to launch another incursion to siege more territory in northern Syria.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Elijah, we had President Raisi of Iran saying that the fate of Syria must be determined by the Syrian people themselves, and also Syria negotiations. The Astana Peace Press also trying to do the same. They bring together representatives from the opposition and also the Syrian central government. But let's speak a little about that.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I agree that the main talk was about Syria. However, there are many other important talks during this three president summit in Tehran. But if that you want to talk about Syria, I think the problem there is Russia cannot stand against Turkey on its own because of the war in Ukraine, because Russia needs allies, and Turkey is not an enemy at the time being. And Russia would do very well with the support of Iran because they both have the same objective to stop President Erdogan from taking a security zone, as he calls it, of 30 kilometers and occupying further land than Idlib and the northwest Syria. This is something that the Russian, the Iranian, and the Damascus agree, and because Erdogan imposed himself as a very important player in Syria, they need to talk with him about it, at least to block him. I am not very optimistic about what's going to happen, because as long as President Erdogan is in power, at least for mid next year, he's not going to give up on Idlib. But I think what the Russian and Iranians are trying to do is to make sure that he's not going to push his forces in the northeast Syria, which are also the Americans present there occupying their part of the country, and they also disagree with President Erdogan's plans because they are the one who are protecting the YPG and the Syrian version of the PKK. So in that regard, I think Iranian, what they are trying to do in this summit, and they have succeeded in a way, is to make sure that President Erdogan looks at the economic benefit that he's getting from his alliance with Iran and with Russia, particularly that is related to the oil and gas, where both countries that are oil and gas producers are going to give Turkey the energy that he needs, and perhaps he will be the channel that will pass it on to the Europeans, and then President Erdogan will weigh the benefit and the damages that he can create in this alliance with Russia and Iran if he moves forward into the Syrian territory. However, we heard the Iranians and we heard the Russians saying that the integrity of Syria is very important and that they are willing to work all together, including President Bashar al-Assad, to work then against the terrorists, whoever they are, because they were not very defined in this conversation, in this summit, for a particular reason, because it is not meant to go into small details. That's why reviving Astana and introducing the fact that it's important to go to a new constitution, all these elements, I think people remain on their position, but the aim now is to calm down the game in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mark, let's now take a look at the stabilizing or destabilizing roles that players, are actually international players, are what they are doing in this region. The U.S. president the other day was talking about what he called Iran's destabilizing role in this region, but I wonder what he's talking about. I mean, if you remember, Iran, General Soleimani helped Iraqis on the request of the Iraqi government to help the nation and government to get rid of Daesh, and he made a great contribution, as you know. Iran is holding this Astana peace process in order to try to bring peace and tranquility back to Syria, getting the opposition representatives and the government to sit at the table and try to address their issues. Iran also offered the Hormuz Peace Initiative during the previous administration, in which it offered Persian Gulf littoral states to again get around the negotiating table and discuss any issues and any points of concerns that they have. So what now, let's compare and to see what actions the U.S. has taken in this region and what Iran is doing. Who's playing a destabilizing role?
I mean, of course, who is destabilizing is in the eye of the beholder. The U.S. imagines itself as the hegemonic power in the Middle East, you know, from the other side of the world. And it manages its hegemony in the Middle East through a tripod relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel, and is constantly working to improve the ties between the two of them. So it is at least something more than a hub and spoke type relationship. And when the U.S. government talks about Iran's destabilizing interests, they mean that it is undermining its hegemony of the region, of the region. And in particular, they're referring to Iran's long principled support of Palestine and their opposition to the Israeli military occupation and slow ethnic cleansing of Palestine, as well, of course, as their own local geopolitical rival with the Saudi dictatorship. So that is what is meant by the term destabilizing, even though the U.S., of course, tries to paint themselves as the good guys and Iran as the bad guys in simplistic Manichaean terms.
Okay, yeah, but Elijah, when you look at what the U.S. has done in this part of the world, the first question is, as Iran is always insisting, that regional states can resolve their regional problems on their own. They don't need any extra-regional power. And given what the U.S. has done in Iraq, in Afghanistan, its proxy war in Yemen, helping the Saudis, and you name it, you know, China and others and Russia, actually the Ukraine thing. So how could you, I mean, this, you cannot square this off with what they're talking about. In the first place, what's the U.S. doing in this part of the world? And is it trying to stabilize this region or destabilize it and set this country off against the other country in order to sell you know, its arms and weaponry and make big bucks?
Well, since 1991, I remember when I was covering the war in Kuwait, the Americans destroyed the infrastructure in Kuwait while Saddam Hussein was withdrawing, and with the aim to rebuild Kuwait and make space for the American companies. In whatever the Americans are doing, starting from demonizing Iran, is to make sure they sell weapons to the Gulf countries, make sure that they separate Iran from the Gulf country, create a havoc in the region, because divide and rule, that is the principle of the Americans, who have no morale in human rights or politics or in their objectives, not only in the Middle East, but also in other parts, in Asia and in Latin America and in Africa, everywhere. What they have done in Iraq is the best example. What they have done in Syria, President Donald Trump had no shame in saying, I want the oil. We had four-star U.S. generals who were saying, have we become pirates? So this is what the Americans is about. By imposing sanctions on Syria, imposing the Caesar Act, preventing Jordan from opening the border for many years, occupying Al-Tanf, the border between Iraq and Syria, is to cripple the Syrian economy, preventing the Gulf country to return to Syria to invest in the reconstruction, is to really break the back of the population. Imposing sanctions on Iran since 1979 under President Jimmy Carter until President Biden today, who continue increasing the sanction, is again to turn the population against their ruler. All these objectives in Lebanon, in Palestine, they are very strong and powerful example of what the U.S. Has been doing in the region to make sure that the region is weak. It's a burned territory. However, we see that this is not going to last forever, because we start seeing very clear indication from countries in the region to meet together, meeting in different parts. Now the Americans are out of the negotiation between Saudis and the Iranians, and the Iranians and the Egyptians and the Jordanians. All that is happening in an Arab Islamic country that is in Iraq. That these are very good signs and strong messages sent to the Americans that we can solve our problem without you, and you better stay away. And that was again reconfirmed during the last meeting and the summit of President Biden in Jeddah, where the language of the Saudis and the Gulf country was positive. It was not demonizing Iran as usual. It was saying extending peace to Iran and saying exactly what the Iranians have been saying. We want to talk together, we want peace, we want to sort out our differences. Now I think the world is shifting.
Now, Mark, another topic that was highlighted in this Astana negotiations, especially just a few hours ago, is trying to fight terrorism and especially terrorism in the region and also including Syria that's located in this region. So, I mean, is this, when you look at it from another perspective, that's how the previous U.S. administration, maybe this one also, was looking. They tried to divide the terrorists into different groups, the good ones and bad ones, and then they, once they supported this group of terrorists, the other day they said these are not good terrorists, and they changed the location. So what is it that they are planning to do? I mean, what's the right way, what's the right course to actually fight and purge terrorism from this region?
Yeah, I mean, the same problem is highlighted in the limitations of the Astana.
Well, we just lost that connection. Elijah, go ahead if you heard my question with the answer.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
In a nutshell, I was asking the right path to fight international terrorism in this region.
Well, international terrorism was the main job, for example, in Syria, of the Syrian government and the Syrian army. They are the one who fought terrorism in Syria in collaboration and the support of their allies. Haj al-Shaabi is the one who fought terrorism in Iraq and not the Americans. They are the one with the Iranian and other allies who stood against the extension of Daesh power that the American watched during Barack Obama without moving. And all this terrorism that has been supported by the Americans in the region is to create a sectarian war among Muslims in the Islamic world to find another way to cripple the economy of the Middle East, to make it engage internally against one another. All that is now over because the population in the countries like in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen stood against the terrorists. And they fought against the terrorists, and this is a card that is no longer valid today. Now, if you look at the region in Syria, in the north, west, and east of Syria, we see the Americans in good terms with Abu Muhammad Julani, who is the ex-emir of Daesh and ex-emir of Al Qaeda, and we see on the other side in the east, they are the ones who are protecting what President Erdogan is saying, the Kurdish terrorists that are the PKK branch, the Syrian branch. So we always see the hand of the Americans in every single support to terrorists in the Middle East, West Asia.
Okay, looks like we have a connection with Mark. Mark, sorry about that technical hitch. Go ahead with your comments.
Yeah, I what we see with the problem with the limitations of the Astana process is the same problems that you see at the United Nations when discussing the topic of terrorism. The problems with defining it and the problems with deciding who the terrorists are, because everyone thinks they're someone different. And the Astana process has achieved a lot, but it's really reached its limitations, because when Russia and Iran and the Syrian government are talking about terrorists, they're principally talking about Al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and the 31 flavors of jihad that have long been the proxies of Turkey and previously the United States and the Gulf Cooperation Council countries in Syria. Meanwhile, when Turkey is talking about terrorists, it's not talking about Al-Qaeda. It does not view them as terrorists. I mean, officially they do, but in reality, they are, of course, arming, funding, and supporting them, cooperating with them. They have for years. They're talking about the YPG and the PKK, and right. It has to be said that Russia does not recognize those groups as terrorists. So in order to avoid a complete breakdown of the Astana process, which the three countries still find useful to a degree for managing their proxy war in Syria. It has kept the conflict effectively frozen for a time. They refer to terrorism without defining who the terrorists are. Turkey's talking about the YPG, the PKK, and Russia, Iran, and Syria, whom they represent, are talking about Turkey's proxies.
Okay. And Elijah, President Putin said that the U.S. agenda for Syria is to plunder its resources. That's happening, and we hear reports just a few days ago, and also disintegrating Syria. Do you share the same view?
I do, actually, because the 23% to 25% of the Syrian territory that is under the U.S. occupation is the basket of food for the Syrian population and the basket of energy, the source of energy for Syria. And now today Syria is relying on the support of Iran and Russia to receive the wheat and the food and the oil that is needed, because the Americans not only have imposed sanctions on Syria that are very harsh and very powerful, but they are stealing the oil and transporting it from Syria to Iraq, and then they are selling it, and they are using it, they're giving it to Turkey, and they exchange it to oil that they take back home. So all that, and preventing the Syrians from recovering their territory, which the Syrian army is very capable of to do today, it's also a way for the Americans that they have no policy, no strategy in Syria today under Joe Biden, is to keep their forces in Syria and to make sure that they cripple the Syrian economy. Now, we also see that their position in Iraq is also complementary to their position in Syria, because the Iraqis will kick them out sooner or later. So they consider that their presence in their area, where they offer support also to the Israelis who are bombing Syria on a regular basis, and the Israelis are using the military air bases and airports that are under the U.S. occupation in the northeast Syria. All these elements represent the policy of the U.S. to really break the Syrian country and the Syrian population, and to make sure they don't recover very quickly.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this special coverage on the Astana peace process and Syria. Let me thank our guests, Mark Sloboda in Moscow and Elijah Magner in Marseille, France.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now, we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kadhim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام إن أصبركم على البلاء لأزهدكم في الدنيا.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "Verily, he who is most persevering in the face of adversity is the most abstemious from among you."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we're talking about the beautiful dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam talked about affection and being considerate and kind to people. It is interesting, we find that the infallible and immaculate Imams, they really spoke about everything that you could imagine, whether it was the regular sciences or whether it was the spiritual sciences or religious sciences such as fiqh and jurisprudence and political, cultural, societal, individual matters. It is very amazing to see how these individuals and these Imams, of course, whose source of knowledge is the Almighty Allah, have such a vast array of knowledge and wisdom. It's really amazing and mind-boggling. And here, in response to showing affection and kindness towards people, when Imam al-Kadhim was talking with his companion, we find that Imam al-Kadhim says to him, showing affection to people is half of intellect. Now, of course, here, you know, we might think that intellect, aql, rationality or logic or this kind of computerized decision-making process, but this intellect, half of it is being kind and showing affection and being considerate to people. So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam here in this conversation with his companion is really telling us that if you are a person who has a high level of intellect, a person who has a high level of rationality and logic, if we want to call aql that as well, but an individual who has intelligence and who has this, again, high level of intellect, then the proof that they have a high level of intellect is that they show affection and they are considerate and they are kind towards people. It's interesting. In this very materialistic and temporal way of thinking that some of us are afflicted with, we think that a high level of intellect means, you know, I don't know, like they're a doctor or an engineer or they're some kind of savvy politician or they can solve the problems of the world. Perhaps this is the other half of intellect, but at least one half of intellect in reality, as Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, is showing affection to people. So if we have an individual who we believe or we imagine has a high level of intellect, but they do not show affection to people, then truly this means that they don't have half of their intellect. They are something else. They're not an intellectual. And what a beautiful way to describe intellect and what a beautiful way to show the signs of true intellect as Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam has done, by saying that half of intellect